Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today is the half moon night, and those of you who've been here during the day will be aware this is 27th of July is Lumpo Sumedho's birthday, 82 years old today. And also we had the Papaja for Sister Tejasa this afternoon. So this is a day of many blessings, a very auspicious day. Particularly today we have in our calendar as Acharya Puja Day, a day to consider Lumpo Sumedho's life and teachings and blessings that we have received from his work, his efforts, his commitment to Dhamma practice over the last 50 years or so. He was born on Asala Puja, the full moon day of July 1934. The 27th was the full moon, just by chance. And that was the day. The Asala Puja is also known as a Dhammachaka Day. It's the day, the beginning of the rains retreat, also the day when the Buddha was understood to have given the first teaching about the middle way and the Four Noble Truths. So over the years, Lumpo Sumedho had a particularly close relationship to the Dhammachaka Pavattana Sutta, that very first discourse, and particularly the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. This this Buddha image here was commissioned and designed by Lumpo Sumedho. If you look closely, you can see it has the Dhamma wheels in the hands of the Rupa, and it was given the name by the late Sangharaja Prabuddha Dhammachakramaravadi, which means the Venerable Buddha who turns the wheel of Dhamma in the deathless realm. So that the turning of the wheel, that first Dhamma teaching of the Buddha, and the teaching that it contains on the Four Noble Truths is a central aspect of Lumpo Sumedho's teaching. So I thought particularly to reflect on that a little bit this evening. One of the points that he used to make quite regularly, particularly because of having been in Thailand and then coming to the West, that he was frequently met with the idea that the Four Noble Truths is a sort of kindergarten Buddhism. That's what the Buddha taught at the beginning of his teaching career. And there's lots more sort of profound and interesting, significant teachings that the Buddha gave later on. And it's not just the view here in the West, but he also would encounter that in Thailand when he was training there, people particularly being fond of Abhidhamma teachings, the sort of analytical philosophical teachings, everything neatly arranged in sort of grids and lines and lists and well-formed patterns describing the nature of the mind and the world and how it all fits together. But he followed the teachings of Lumpo Cha and Venerable Buddhadasa in particular, who pointed out over and over again that rather than the Four Noble Truths being a kind of kindergarten Buddhism or a sort of preliminary teaching or a foundational teaching that is then sort of built on and superseded later on, that it's sort of surpassed by later teachings, Both Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Buddhadasa would emphasize over and over again, it's not, the Four Noble Truths is not just a simple teaching that you get beyond, but it's the very core and the very framework within which all of the rest of the teachings exist. And that's the kind of imagery that the Buddha used himself. There's a sutta called the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint. And he says, just as the footprint of the elephant contains, or you can put the footprints of every other animal in the forest or in the wilderness will fit within the footprint of the elephant, so too that all other teachings fit within the Four Noble Truths. That the Four Noble Truths is like the elephant's footprint that is all encompassing, that contains everything else. So over and over again, those of you who've listened to Lumpur Sumedho's teachings or read his books, you'll have heard this theme over and over, that it's not a kind of beginner's Buddhism that you learn about on chapter one, page one, you know, the Four Noble Truths. Then you transcend with the Vajrayana teachings or the Zen teachings or the Abhidhamma teachings. But he emphasized that it's not just a theory that you comprehend, you understand intellectually, and then you get beyond, but rather to establish the Four Noble Truths as the very framework within which each of us meet our moment-to-moment experience. And as it says, when the Buddha defines right view, you know, he says what the right view is. Seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And again, that is sometimes represented as, okay, you know, right view means believing that the Four Noble Truths are true. But Lumpur Sumedho would emphasize over and over again, that's not, if you look at it and you reflect on it and you really consider the Buddha's words on this, it's not a matter of believing the words of the Four Noble Truths to be accurate, that is right view, but rather the right view is describing a way of receiving, a way of meeting each moment, and that to say that right view means seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. What that means is that in this very moment, It's seeing things in terms of the framework of, is there dukkha? Is there a feeling of incompleteness or insufficiency? Is there a feeling of things not being quite right, not being quite in order, of things being imbalanced or lacking? Is there any kind of a quality of things being fragile or incomplete? Is there dukkha? And if there is that experience of dukkha, of wrongness, of things being out of balance or incomplete, unsatisfying, not ownable, and so on, then to look and see if there's dukkha, it's arisen from a cause. That means that if there's dukkha, if there is that dissatisfaction, that means the mind is attached to something, is identified with something. So, you know, what is it? What's the mind hanging on to? Is it hanging on to something it wants to get rid of? Is it hanging on to something that it wants to experience, to smell or taste or touch? Is it afraid of losing something that it believes it possesses? Is it trying to get hold of something that it wants to have to complete in itself? What's it hanging on to? What's the mind attached to? Where is the tanha? Seeing where the tanha is, seeing where that quality of craving or attachment, clinging is located, then the Eightfold Path describes how to work with it, whether it's in terms of the sense object or an aspect of the inner world. The Eightfold Path describes the means whereby that that clinging is let go of, and the Dhamma is realized. And then the result of the Eightfold Path having been followed, the cure having been taken, as it were, then that results in dukkha nirodha, the ending of dukkha. The things are back in balance. And so rather than the Four Noble Truths being a kind of set of principles that you believe in or that you think is accurate, it's a way of handling this moment. It's a way of looking for what the mind is chasing after, is fearing, is hoping for, is regretting, is owning, and so on and so on, and telling us what to do with it. And through that seeing clearly, that letting go, that waking up, then the mind, the heart arrives at the quality of dukkha nirodha, that dissatisfaction ceases. There is satisfaction. There is the quality of integration, balance, wholeness that is realized. So I feel if we are wanting to express our respect to Lumpur Sumedho, along with having lots of flowers and putting a special picture up and lighting candles and mentioning his name, reading his words out of books, the best way of respecting the teacher is to put the teachings into practice. And so that this is what I would encourage, getting to know the Four Noble Truths and making use of them as a teaching in this kind of moment-to-moment way. Another aspect of the teaching on the Four Noble Truths that's there in the Dhammacakka Sutta, we chanted it this evening. That was not an accident. It was, I think, the very first sutta that we, as a community, learnt to recite together back in the early 80s. Ajahn Sumedho had us learn that and recite that together in the early days of Chithurst. And one of the aspects of that teaching that's spelled out there in that Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is that for each of the four truths, there's a particular means of working with it. As it said, the four truths in their three modes. So maybe some of you have come across that terminology in some of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings and you're wondering what that refers to. But in that section of the chanting, as we were doing the Udapadi section, where we're doing all the Udapadis, then what it does, it goes through each of the four truths, which are sort of divided up into like a medical diagnosis as the symptom, the cause, the prognosis and the cure. So the dukkha is the symptom, dukkha samudaya, the origin is the cause of dukkha. Samudaya means the arising or where it comes from. So then the prognosis, is it curable? As dukkha nirodha, yes, it's curable. And then the fourth truth describes the treatment. The Eightfold Path is the method of treatment whereby you get from the state of the illness, the malaise, the ailment of dukkha having been caused, how you get to freedom from the disease, how you get to dukkha nirodha. So each of those four has a particular way in which they are worked with or developed. And this was an aspect of the teaching that Lumpur Sumedho found particularly helpful for himself. And I think many of us, similarly, it was a way of helping to understand that these are not, say, ideas to believe in, but processes to be developed. They're in a way, four noble tasks, four noble activities or undertakings, rather than four high-minded ideas. So the first one, dukkha itself, the Pali is parinyayanti. So that means something like dukkha is to be understood or to be apprehended. It is to be appreciated. So what this means on a very practical level means to recognize that you're suffering, to recognize that there is this feeling of incompleteness or insecurity, or a sense of being threatened, or a sense of being irritated, or lacking something that you want. Just to be able to apprehend that, and to know this is dukkha, idang dukkang, this is dukkha. This is the feeling of imbalance. That's what's here. Most of the time, as I found for myself, looking at my own life, that I don't notice that, first of all. My mind goes to judging things as, oh, that's attractive, that's interesting, or oh, that's upsetting, or oh, that's worrying, or oh, that's annoying. That the mind immediately gives a value to the sense object, the memory that we have, or the mood that's arisen, the thing that we see or smell or taste or touch. The mind says, oh, that is attractive, or that is frightening, or that is annoying, that is regrettable, or that is promising. It immediately sort of goes out and invests the object with that value. It says, no, that is attractive. These are beautiful flowers. This is an interesting person. It is delicious smelling food, or that is revolting smelling person. Even if it's you. that kind of ascription, giving the value to the object, is what the mind does. It says, no, these are beautiful flowers, or this is a solid oak seat. It assumes that the judgment is real. So this first step, the first stage of appreciating, apprehending dukkha, is in a sense drawing the attention off the object as being attractive or frightening or worrying or annoying or interesting or named as mine or yours or whatever, to turn the attention back onto the felt sense of experiencing that oh, this is the experience of wanting, or this is the experience of fearing, this is the experience of being jealous or being annoyed or being excited. That's what this is. So there's a way of using the Four Noble Truths and bringing them to life, and say the method of working with the first truth, the task of the first truth, is turning the attention around 180 degrees to look at what is your heart doing with that sense impression. Is it saying, oh, I'm incomplete until I've got some of that pizza? Yeah. those flowers were beautiful, but now they've gone over. That turning the attention and looking at what is happening in the heart, that's the first stage. And then to recognize, oh, this is dukkha. And it's kind of surprising. But sometimes we can dwell on some particular problem, like there's a conflict between us and somebody else, or we're worried about someone who's suffering a lot, that we're concerned about their welfare, or we're worried about a particular issue in the world or in the monastery, or a particular a health problem. There's a weird feeling in your back or in your guts, or there's some kind of strange rash that's appeared. Whatever it might be, and it seems like a reasonable thing to be worried about, or to be annoyed with, or to be wanting. And we can live with it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I've certainly done this myself. You live for weeks and weeks with some particular stress in the system. And I remember one particular time when I was living here back in the early 90s, and I was myself and the then Ajahn Atapema, we looked after the office here. He was the English Sangha Trust secretary, and I was the Amravati Monastery secretary. So we were a sort of dual administration team, and it was not always easy working together. I'm sure he won't mind me saying that. Said it a few times. it was not a secret that it was not always easy to work together. And so I remember one particular time where there'd been a certain sense of struggle that had been going on for a month or 6 weeks or so. And then suddenly I was in the sala, and I think I was just rearranging the mats after the mealtime one day. And so it was not really connected with Ajahnutapema or any particular event at that moment, but it was sort of running through my mind about the stress of this particular relationship, the sort of difficulty of working together. And suddenly it crossed my mind, this is association with the disliked is dukkha. Appiehi sampayogo dukkho. We chant that every day in the morning chanting. Association with the disliked is dukkha. This is disliked. I'm associated with it. Therefore, dukkha. A plus B equals C. Oh, that's what's happening. This is dukkha. And even though it might, you might be thinking, so what? It was quite a revelation at the time. It was just, oh, this is the experience of dukkha. It's not about me or him or how we can make it right. What's happening in this moment is, and this is the mind associated with the disliked, therefore there's dukkha. That's all. That's what this is. It's simply the experience of association with the disliked. Aha! And so it was astonishing, surprising to me how having sort of carried some issue around for a month or 6 weeks, just in that one moment, which literally 2 or 3 seconds, like, oh, this is association with the disliked, therefore dukkha. Ha! It was just, it resolved itself just in those few seconds. Not that we worked out every single aspect of functioning together in a harmonious way, but seeing that the mind was hanging on to the particular mood or the particular attitude, and was creating dukkha out of it. And as soon as there was that apprehending, the parinyayanti to meet, oh, this is the feeling of dukkha. This is being associated with the disliked, therefore dukkha. Aha! Then there was a bringing into balance. There was a kind of aligning. Things lined up and were able to be understood and to be integrated. And then speaking of the word understanding or understood, this was a particular way that Lumpur Sumedho liked to talk about this parinyayanti. It is to be understood. So the English word to understand means to comprehend or to know what the meaning of something is. But and so that sometimes that will be the translation of that particular term, to understand dukkha. But Lumpur Sumedho used to like to interpret as standing under. So literally to understand means to stand under something. And he would use that as an image to talk about this parinyayanti, to stand under the dukkha, to kind of like standing under the shower, like letting it land on top of you. Like, this is dukkha, this is what's happening. This is the feeling of things being out of balance. And so I think that's quite a useful image to bear in mind, standing under it. So I like the word apprehending. It's a bit of a long word. I know most people here do not have English as your first language, but apprehending means like to receive in a conscious way, to allow something in and to accept it, to receive it, to take hold of it. Because what happens when we apprehend dukkha, we stand under it, we receive it, is that that in that very recognition, you're in a sense awakening the intuition, the wisdom that something can be done about this. This feeling of wrongness has arisen. It's a formed thing. It's not that is a permanent problem, or that is something that you've got to have to make you feel whole. That's something that you've got to get rid of to make yourself feel pure. No, it's what is happening is this is the feeling of imbalance, and it's come from grasping. It's come from that quality of identification. So it the heart recognizes through that apprehending, through that receiving, oh, this is this is just the experience of dukkha. Therefore, something can be done with this. This is not some kind of permanent difficulty or permanent problem. So that the way of opening up the door, allowing that recognition in that this is dukkha, idang dukkang, then reveals, it shows us that this can be worked with. This is not an immovable or impossible issue. So then the second truth, the task or the way of working with the second truth, dukkha samudaya, is pahata banti. Pahanati is to let go of, to release or to relinquish. And so pahata banti means it should be let go of, so that when the Buddha defines that the cause of dukkha, the cause of that quality of imbalance or disintegration, things being, incomplete or unsatisfying, he points out that it's based on tanha, on craving, craving for sense pleasure, karma tanha, or the craving to be, to exist, bhava tanha, to be something, or vibhava tanha, the craving to not be, to not feel, to switch off, to be annihilated, to get rid of. And again, this is an area of the teachings that Lumpur Sumedho gave an enormous amount of attention to. And many of us will have heard and read his teachings over and over again on this. But the reason why he would speak about it over and over is because it's extraordinarily helpful to understand and to work with this. Particularly because when you see most Buddhist texts talking about the Four Noble Truths, it says, you know, desire is the cause of suffering, or craving is the cause of suffering. And mostly what they highlight is a desire, like desire for sense pleasure, karma tanha, which is first on the list and is, for most of us, it is a very significant issue, that desire to have things that we like, to see and hear and smell and taste and touch, desire for pleasant things. That desire for sense pleasure is a major motivating force for most of us in the human world. But where Lumpur Sumedho's teaching differed from a lot of the teachings of other ajahns, and where he made a particular emphasis, was that he saw that most people who are interested, particularly in the West, people who are interested in meditation, they weren't kind of big-time sensualists. That people were not particularly given towards sensual indulgence. The kind of people who had come to Amravati or Chithurst Monastery, to our branch monasteries, the average person in the West who was keen on meditation, they weren't particularly interested in having lots of money or having, a big house, or they weren't particularly interested in being famous or rich, or they were not very indulgent in their habits. And he would remark how, you know, oftentimes the people who were lay people coming to take part in meditation retreats or stay in the monastery, they often were far more modest and had, you know, more humble possessions than many of the monastics did. Which is kind of embarrassing. So he realized, well, yeah, you know, for many people, the kind of people that are coming along and listening to Dhamma talks, the kind of people that are coming on retreats, talking a lot about karma tanha, about sense, the desire for sense pleasure. Yeah, I mean, we get hungry at the mealtime, and breakfast is interesting, you know, on an empty stomach at 7 in the morning, for sure. But, you know, these are not kind of super sensualist type of people. We're not, so they're not people who are building their lives around the sort of insatiable pursuit of sense pleasure, like chasing one thrill after another. This is not the way most of these good people are operating. And so he also saw that what is a problem, though, what is an area that is difficult to understand and really causes a lot of suffering, is how these other two aspects of tanha, bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, the desire to become and the desire to get rid of, these two are really powerful features of the meditation life of pretty much everyone who's coming on the retreat, and the people aspiring to monastic life, people wanting to take on the life of an anagarika or anagarika, to taking going into robes as a siladhara or as a novice or as a bhikkhu. That bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, these were far more sort of prominent and significant and obstructive in terms of spiritual life, because the desire to become disguises itself as spiritual development. And the desire to get rid of it similarly disguises itself as an aspect of spiritual development. And so he would see that people coming to the monastery, people who are listening to the teachings, they want to get jhana, they want to get insight, they want to get concentrated, they want to become enlightened, they want to become a stream enterer. And many of the books that people are reading and the inspiring teachings that they've spent a lot of time studying, the suttas that they're reading in the Pali canon, so much of it is saying, yeah, you need to develop jhana, you need to develop insight, you need to become a stream enterer, a once returner, a non-returner, become an arahant. And it seems like you're doing all the right things. And in terms of vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of, it says, yeah, you should get rid of greed, get rid of hatred, get rid of delusion, get rid of your conceit, get rid of your jealousy and your anger and your fear and your restlessness, get rid of the five hindrances. Get rid of sense desire and ill will. Get rid of restlessness and dullness. Get rid of doubt. And so people will be working really hard with great sincerity and commitment, trying to become all these good things and get rid of all these other obstructive things. And so the emphasis of much of Lumpo Samhita's meditation teaching was right at this area of understanding bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, these, in a way, the sort of the quiet relatives of the sense desire. Gets a sort of a banner headline. It's sort of very obvious and clear, like, I want cake, or I want a big house, or I want to drive a fancy new BMW or something. That it seems to grab the center stage, but the more dangerous qualities were these quiet characters around the edges. Well, I want to get concentrated. I want to develop my spiritual life. I want to get rid of my jealousy and fear. I want to get rid of my chattering mind, my distracted thoughts. So it's because they seem to be reasonable and useful and good that we get drawn into the habits of bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. So Lumpo Samhita spent a great deal of time spelling this out, and for myself I found this incredibly useful, because like most other people I was deeply embedded in trying to become concentrated, trying to get insight, trying to become enlightened, trying to get rid of my chattering thoughts and get rid of greed, hatred, delusion, jealousy, laziness, lust, and fear, and so on. So in terms of Lumpo Samhita's legacy in the world, and particularly in his meditation guidance, I feel this is one of the most wonderful and powerful areas of teaching that's extraordinarily useful. And when you look at it, consider the issues, it can be confusing, because you say, well, doesn't it says in these books, and these really great enlightened teachers are saying, get rid of your greed, hatred, and delusion. They are saying become a stream enterer. They are saying you need to get jhana and so on. Yeah, how is it that somehow this is the wrong thing? Or if I'm not supposed to be doing this and getting rid of that, what am I supposed to be doing? what's the right path? And in this, as Lumpo Sumedho would emphasize, and I follow in his footsteps in this respect, the main difference, the essential difference between what is the development of right effort and what is the development of bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, what makes one the cure and the other the cause of the problem, is self-view, the feelings of I and me and mine. Because the desire to become, the desire to get rid of, it's always cast in the framework of I. I need to get concentrated. I need to get jhana. I need to develop more insight. I need to get rid of my chattering thoughts. I need to get rid of my my doubts. It's all I have got. I need to get rid of. I want to become. I need to get. It's all cast in that format of I. Or it's a similar phrase that he would speak about over and over again. I'm an unenlightened person who needs to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future. Again, he would point out this is all bound up together with us, with I and me and mine. It's bound up with self-view, the idea that I am this person who is an unenlightened person who's got to do something to become an enlightened person in the future. In that very phrasing, the way the mind puts that together as an idea, there's a me here who is a separate individual person, and I exist in time, and then me later on at a different time, the same person will be one who is an enlightened person rather than an unenlightened person. So what he would point to is that feeling of I and me and mine, the self-view, and to say that's the culprit, that's the troublemaker, that's the thing that is causing the confusion. If self-view is let go of, and then the mind wakes up to the present moment, then it's recognized that I am an unenlightened person is a thought. It's a thought that arises and passes away. It's not self. It's not who and what you are. It's just a thought. It doesn't have to be believed in. It doesn't have to be rejected. If it's known simply as a thought, then in that very moment, the mind is awake. There is light. There is enlightenment. The mind is enlightened with wisdom. The light of wisdom is shining in the mind at that moment. So similarly, if we understand that the practice of meditation, the development of concentration and insight and so forth, that is the essential elements of the path, and the Buddha's teaching is based around these qualities. The difference between the development of right effort and what we call bhava tanha and vibhava tanha is that right effort, or samma vayama, has no sense of self. There's no I or me or mine involved in it. So in the development of right effort, the application of right effort, then you have the encouragement to restrain the unwholesome, sangvara, to restrain the unwholesome states from arising, or if they have arisen, to let go of them, pahanati, to let go. So sangvara, pahana, if the unwholesome have arisen, to let go. To cultivate the wholesome, bhavana, to consciously bring wholesome qualities into being, concentration, loving-kindness, compassion, wisdom, insight, so forth. And then if wholesome qualities have arisen, then the effort is to sustain them. So these are the four aspects of right effort: restraining, letting go, cultivating, maintaining. And so that might seem very much like bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. You're trying to stop the bad stuff from happening and to get the good stuff to happen instead. But if you pay attention to the way it's phrased and talked about, and that makes all the difference in the world, then it's seen that this is the effort that's being made without a sense of I or me or mine woven together in with it. It's free from self-view, free from conceit. So work is being done, as goals are being set, there's a direction being given, going from distraction to concentration, going from doubt to freedom from doubt, going from agitation to freedom from agitation. Yes, there's definitely a direction being given, there's work being done, but it's not like I'm an agitated person who needs to stop being agitated so I can be peaceful in the future, but rather here is the experience of agitation. This can be let go of, and the motivation to let go of it, and then the letting go can happen, so that then a freedom from agitation is established, the peacefulness is established, and that can be brought about without any I or me or mine involved in it. So the second noble truth, the way that that's worked is with the cause of suffering, tanha, craving, is let go of. The third noble truth, dukkha nirodha, needs to be realized. Satchikata banti. Satcha is truth, or reality. So satchikata banti means it needs to be realized. So this is a subtle teaching, but again, one I found extraordinarily helpful, and Lumpo Sumedho would speak about it. Because what he would point at is that peace is really boring. You'll have heard, maybe you've heard him say that. Peace is really boring. Sex and drugs, violence is interesting. Peace is really boring. They don't, again, you will have heard him say over and over again, those of you who've been around his teachings, they'll never make a headline in the newspaper, Ajahn Sumedho has an out-breath. You know, the Daily Mirror, he would say, would never put me on the front cover saying, the Venerable Sumedho breathed in and then he breathed out. Banner headline. Ta-da! You know, so that's not going to sell very many newspapers. Yeah, but if Venerable Sumedho has gone off with a 16-year-old, that would sell newspapers. The Buddhist monk elopes with teenager, that would sell a lot of papers. So that that lack of interest, peace is boring. What that means is that when dukkha ends, you have to pay attention to it. Satchikata banti means it needs to be realized, because if it's not consciously realized, the attention will just wander to the next interesting thing. It's just like, say, here during the last week, we've had quite a lot of machine noise going on around the temple. At least I have noticed. Some of you maybe didn't notice. You're busy paying attention to other things. But I noticed a certain amount of lawnmowers, our good friends Jorge and Gatis, doing lots of good work cutting the ever-growing grass. And some machinery, building of the people building the nursing kuti, and other activities going on in the workshop. And so you can be sitting here and hearing the sound of the mower, and then the machine stops, and then there's this feeling of, wow, it's so quiet. So for about 3 or 4 seconds, it's consciously pleasant and noticeable, because the contrast of noise to not noise is very obvious. But after those 3 or 4 seconds, the not noise experience disappears from our perceptions, because not noise, silence, is not interesting. So then after 3 or 4 seconds, at least if your mind is anything like mine, the mind starts to look for the next interesting thing, a thought or a sensation in the body or a memory, or it'll pick up something else. So when we talk about dukkha nirodha needing to be realized, it's in a sense keeping your attention on the space, keeping your attention on the silence after the mower or the machine has stopped, not to just notice that in the first few seconds, or the contrast between, say, grasping and not grasping, or dukkha and not dukkha, but to not just let the attention wander, but to sustain it on that quality of space, silence, stillness. And that takes effort because it's not interesting. Space does not grab our attention. People are really interesting. The spaces between people are not interesting. At least in my experience, the spaces don't have names. The people have names. It's, you know, Ajahn Kongrit, Ajahn Yanadasno, Ajahn Ahingsako. The spaces between them don't have names. It's just that the gap between Ajahn Kongrit and Ajahn Yanadasno. It's nothing special. It doesn't have a life story. It doesn't have a history. So in a sense, and this is the most challenging of the four tasks, I find, is this Sacchikata Bhanti, to realize dukkha nirodha. Because when dukkha stops, there naturally, just like the sound of a machine stopping, when there's a letting go, the mind has been grasping a fear or a hope or a desire or an opinion, some kind of grasping of a feeling of I, atavarupadana, grasping the I feeling, dittupadana, grasping an opinion, karmupadana, grasping a sense pleasure, a sensual feeling, the different kinds of grasping. And then when it stops, there's this feeling of, ah, how nice that the grasping has stopped. I let go of that opinion. I let go of that feeling of I. I let go of that sense desire. I let go of that irritation. Ah. And just like the machine stopping, you have 3 or 4 seconds of conscious pleasure. Ah. And then if you pay attention, if you notice, then 3 or 4 seconds go by and then the mind starts to hunt for the next interesting thing, the next thing to have an opinion about, the next thing to get interested in or annoyed by or to remember or to plan. This is the conditioning of the mind. It starts to look for the next interesting thing because our conditioning as animals of our animal ancestry is to look for the next thing that's going to be edible, we can eat, the thing that might eat us, the thing that we can mate with, something that's entering our territory, or something that promises more territory for us. This is our conditioning, the instincts that we have. So it takes a conscious effort to not follow that instinct, but to let the mind attend to that absence of dukkha, not just to notice it when the grasping stops. So the fourth task then, with the Eightfold Path, is development, bhaveta bhanti. It is to be developed. So the Eightfold Path, it's not just sort of something that comes in a single package, but it's something that's worked. It's like a developing, like when speaking again of our mowing team, developing a path through the grass, developing the track around the field so people can walk in a clear and unobstructed way. That path is developed. The mugga, the path, needs to be developed. Should be developed, bhaveta bhanti. If you don't develop the path, the grass grows up and you haven't got a path anymore. It needs to be developed in order to make it something that can be walked and give free passage. So in exactly the same way, the aspects of the Eightfold Path around sila, right speech, right action, right livelihood, the aspects of concentration, mind training, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and the aspects of wisdom, samadhi, right view, and samasankappa, right view, right resolution, right thought. Yeah, these are the way that the path is developed, that they are, say, picked up and used and worked, just like learning a musical instrument, learning a language, learning any kind of skill, learning a computer program, learning how to drive a mower, yeah. Learning how to be a nun. So Sister Tejasa, she's a Sila Dara of about 6 hours standing. She's got a lot of rules she has to learn, and then, so that she, it's a skill that she needs to develop just to become a Sila Dara today. So there's a lot of new things to learn, a lot of information to memorize, a lot of aspects of conduct that need to be kind of brought into being and developed. So that the fourth task is that conscious picking up of the mind training, sila, samadhi, and panya, virtue, concentration, and wisdom, and bringing those into being, and so that those skills of recognizing what's going on, how to work with it, that can be recognized and used, and that letting go of the origin and the realization of the cessation can be more completely and fully established moment by moment. Well, these are some aspects of Lumpur Samedo's teachings. I thought to share. This is one of the many great gifts that he left. This place would not exist. And speaking of other gifts, Lumpur Samedo was one of great initiative. He was someone who was ready to take risks and to not just follow the easy way, but he took risks, and we are the beneficiaries of his risks. Creating the Nuns Order, the Sila Dara Order, over 30 years ago, that was a big risk. Opening Amaravati, Chithurst Monastery had only been open for less than 5 years. It was Chithurst Monastery began in June of 1979, and the initiative to open up Amaravati was launched in 1983, just about four and a half years later. So that's not a very long time. So, and Chithurst House had hardly even been finished, the fixing up of this old crumbled, dry rot filled Victorian mansion. That the place had hardly been repaired before already. It was too small to accommodate all of our community. And as Lumpur Samedo often said, and it's there, his own account of it is there in our 30th anniversary book, he said, you know, there we were at Chithurst, and we'd fixed up the house, we'd repaired the building and put a new roof on, and I was really enjoyed it. And he said, I felt I could just live here in the beautiful Sussex countryside and look out over the Rother Valley and enjoy the South Downs filling the southern horizon, and just have a quiet life with a few of my favorite monks and nuns all around, and just tell people, sorry, I haven't got any more room for anybody else, and just have a quiet life. So I could do that, but I realized I can't do that. Because there's more people who want to enter the community. There's more people who want to be on retreat. There's more people who wish to train in the holy life. So we have to do something else. So it was already an extraordinary undertaking to have established Chithurst and the Nuns Order, and to have fixed up that whole house just within those few years, from 1979 to 1983. But it's quite marvelous, and we are literally the beneficiaries of that thought in the mind of Ajahn Sumedho, saying, no, I can't just look out for myself. I can't just let things sit with a comfortable, easy option for myself. We have to do more. I can't just stop things here. It's not about my comfort, my convenience, or what my preference is. And so that's why Amaravati exists. And he was talking out loud, or thinking out loud to some people, and talking at tea time one day at Chidhurst, and said, you know, we need to find a place somewhere north of London, but close to London, so it could be a teaching center as well as a forest monastery. And we need to find some kind of old school or something that's definitely not got a preservation order on it. It's not a listed building, something that we can knock down or do anything that we like with. And he was just thinking out loud in this way. And so then a couple of the people who were there, Barbara and Peter Jackson, said, well, would you like us to start looking at Tanajan? And he said, yes. So that was in 1983, towards the end of 83, I believe. And so Chidhurst hadn't even been open for 5 years. I've been back here at Amaravati already over 5 years. I've been here 6 years now. 5 years is not a very long time. But yet he was ready to risk everything. And it wasn't as though the English Sangha Trust had enough money to buy this place. All the money to buy Amaravati had to be borrowed from the bank. Pretty much all of it. Most of it had to be borrowed. But so it was opening up a place with... 20 plus buildings that were uninsulated, starting a whole new venture, starting a retreat center, setting a place up to be like an interfaith gathering place as a teaching center. No other branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's tradition had done anything like this ever before. It was a big risk. Yeah, setting a place up to be a teaching center, to be a retreat center, an interfaith gathering venue. Well, these are all brand new ideas that Lumpo Sumedho was ready to try out, to risk, to see whether it would work. And so the very fact that we're in this temple on this evening, July 27th, or more than 30 years later, is because he took those risks. And the reason why, you know, Sister Tejasar could become a Sila Dara today is because Lumpur Sumedho took those risks. And so it's not just his skill in teaching about the Four Noble Truths, but also his grandness of heart and incredible generosity, his incredible readiness to be available for people and to teach. And this is last year, so he retired from here back in 2010, went back to live in Thailand to enjoy some solitude and a quiet life. But then, as he said, so I realized, well, I've been sort of just by myself for the last 4 years, and I've still got plenty of energy, and people seem to like hearing me speak, and I get a lot of juice from teaching and talking to people, and I like to talk about the Dhamma, and people like to hear it. So why don't I just do some more teaching? And he had a whole pile of different invitations that had arrived over time. He said, Brazil, I've been invited to Brazil. Why don't we go to Brazil? So off he went to Brazil, led a 10-day retreat in Sao Paulo, and Uruguay, and Chile. So at the age of 80, 81, he embarks on a whole 4-month-long teaching tour through the Southern Hemisphere, Brazil, Uruguay, Chile, New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, Malaysia. He was a bit pooped by the time he got back to Thailand. But that's also representative of his great spirit of, like, well, why just sit here enjoying the forest at Ratanawan Monastery in Korat in Thailand? Why not share the Dhamma? There are those who are interested to hear, so why not put forth the effort and travel, be available for those who wish to listen to and to practice. So these are a few reflections for this evening, and so obviously I'm a completely unapologetic Lumpur Sumedho fan. and have been for many, many years since I met him in October of 1979. My life is unimaginable what it would be like if I hadn't met Lumpur and been blessed with his teachings and his presence and his friendship for all these years. But I feel that I'm not the only one who's benefited from his generosity and his life. And so I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening and encourage us to bring to mind all that we might feel grateful for, and in terms of what Lumpur Sumedho has offered us, and to offer up our own good wishes, our sense of gratitude, katanyu, and also katavedi, to dedicate our life, our actions, our intentions to, to be living and practicing in a way that would be inspiring and gladdening to Lumpur's heart, because the thing that pleases a teacher most of all is when people actually follow their instructions. That's the greatest puja, is to do what the teacher teaches you. It's more challenging than flowers and the candles, but it's more pleasing and more helpful in the long run. Here one.